We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now that's what I call science. Hello, listeners. You're tuned into That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio and podcast show that brings independent and interesting STEM, so that's science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine, to you from Tasmania. This show is supported by Edge Radio, Hobart's premium news station. So head on over to edge.org.au for more information about them. I'd like to begin today's episode by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording, the Palo and Pakana. We're recording here on Luchuita, but as we are a podcast, we would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from where you, our listener, are tuning in from. On behalf of everyone here in the studio, I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. My name is Ollie Dove and I'm joined today by my co-host Hannah Moore. And today we'll be talking to Dr. Emiliano Cimoli about all things remote sensing, drones and photogrammetry, which I think I pronounced right, but we'll find out shortly. And I'll hand over to Hannah now to introduce our guest, Moore.
Thank you very much, Ollie. Emiliano is currently a research associate at the Australian Centre of Excellence in Antarctic Science. He completed his PhD at the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies and has a previous background in civil engineering through both his BSc in Italy and his MSc from Denmark. His research focuses on the development and application of remote sensing methods to map and understand biophysical systems across the land and sea. Emiliano will help us break this down if you're not quite sure what this stuff means. So Emiliano, welcome to the show. So the listeners have a bit of context for what your research is. What exactly is remote sensing? Could you please explain that to us?
Well, yeah, thanks a lot. I didn't realize that title was so convoluted. Actually, now I'm going to have to actually break it down. So remote sensing, well, probably this podcast have interviewed so many people that are, you know, looking at several systems, most of them at sea, probably here at IMAS, some of them working at IMAS, but some of them in terrestrial application, and most of them, they have to get in, observe their targets, several biologists or ecologists, they have to get into the field, they have to collect samples about several targets and so on to make their studies and analyze how trends are going, if a population of some specific species is declining or, you know, going well as climate changes and so on. Remote sensing is kind of that discipline which try to get some of these observations that scientists do usually in the field, but remotely with less effort possible, right? There are several ways that we can do remote sensing, which we can go, you know, which we can delve deep into it. And there is a full field, which, you know, we can take hours to explain. But the base concept of remote sensing is that we observe without touching based on physics properties. And, you know, we have sensors and so on. And we can kind of, we don't get the same results as accurate as people does in the field, like biologists or ecologists or volcanologists or people sample things to get observations, but we kind of get them a bit easier and a bit more spatially complete. So it's kind of a way to complete what people, scientists do in the field, to gather their observation about species, plants, rocks, whatever. Being able to do it remotely without getting non-invasively, without getting in contact with the medium, and of course at larger spatial extents, right? So we know that the world is changing, the surface is changing, plants are changing, animal population are changing all the time. We try to capture this more efficiently. That makes sense?
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. We're going to take a deep dive into your research a little bit later on, but we'd love to know what your interests were when you were younger and what inspired you to get into this field.
To be honest, no, I wasn't into engineering. I was more, oh, I wanted to do history, stuff like that. Then, you know, or arts and industrial design was one of them. Well, you know, then I got kind of my father's influence a little bit in the beginning. It was like, oh, you know, maybe you can start with engineering. You know, that's how it goes. And then I started, first of all, he was expecting very high grades. Then he said, oh, I just want you to pass. And he realized it wasn't much of a success. But, you know, we managed to get through. So that was fun. And then I felt in love with pretty pictures of the world, of the planet. Those most of them several sensors and satellite sensors. So airborne sensors. And then you can produce these beautiful maps, which kind of had this very artistic side to it. And I was like, oh, I like this. And then you can kind of have this mix between doing numbers and so on, and with producing kind of nice, pretty products about stuff, satellite, I mean, image products. Well, then it was kind of a trap, because at the end of the day, you're most of the time coding or doing computer stuff, so not many pretty pictures, but that's how I got into it.
So you have been to a lot of places for your studies. Starting off, you were in Italy, and then you moved to Denmark for your master's, and then you finally come to Tasmania. So what actually brought you to Tasmania? What was the inspiration behind coming to Tassie?
Oh, that's, I mean, it's not going to sound so romantic, but I literally wasn't the internet. I had my finished my master's, and then I had no idea what to do. I loved my topic. I was working on glaciers before in Greenland and Svalbard. And then I literally found findaphd.com, and there was a project advertised about a topic which was sounded really fascinating. So I was always had this passion about the sea, but I've been working on glaciers, and then glaciers, this means like mountain glaciers. And then I saw this project about mapping sea ice. So it was kind of the sea, and there was the ice of the glaciers. And I had no background in marine science before, but because I did, you know, civil engineering. And then I saw this project on the internet. I said, oh, this sounds interesting. And then, you know, first of all, I say, where is the location? Tasmania, Google, where is Tasmania? First step. And then that was pretty much it. I got it, and then I told my parents I'm going to Tasmania, and they didn't know what it was, but I had to explain it through, and here I am 7 years later, happy enough. So that's pretty much what took me here. It was just a very interesting project with good team.
Well, I'm glad that you think you made the right decision. Stick with us for part two as we delve into Emiliano's research using remote sensing. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and today we're joined by Emiliano Cimoli, and we're talking about remote sensing. So, Emiliano, let's talk more about your research. So you're mapping biophysical properties in marine and terrestrial vegetated landscape. So first of all, what exactly do you mean by biophysical properties? Just because some of the listeners might not know exactly what that is. And also, why do we need to map these biophysical properties?
So biophysical properties. So, you know, we refer mostly at that combination between physical. So if you look at the landscape and you see a forest, you will see the physical properties of it. So how tall are the trees, how wide are them, how distributed they are, how the leaves are, you know, how big are the leaves and so on. And then biological properties, we can look at how much chlorophyll that tree has, or how much nitrogen, or how much water stress. So those are the biological properties of the system. The combination of being able to map both the physical properties of a system, so in the case of a forest or a tree, with the biological, which are all interconnected between themselves, it's kind of looking at a biophysical system. Like, you can talk about this in forestry. What I specialize is sea ice algae, which is it's communities of algae living underneath the ice in Antarctica. And this really depends on so they live attached to the ice, and the properties of the ice, so the physical properties of the ice, for example, the roughness, the topography, the snow on top, really regulates the biological properties, so much algae it's in the ice. So if it's more rough, maybe more aggregation of algae on the ice. If there is it thicker, it means less light going through, so it means less algae. So it's the physical properties of the system, the sea ice, or how the forest is built, and the biological properties of the system, which is the living community that's there and its properties, so its physiology. The combination of those two is the biophysical system. And biologists and ecologists, they monitor this the best on a very finer scale. So we try to extrapolate this with remote sensing. So monitor this using sensors without touching them, because sometimes you don't want to touch them.
Yeah, fair enough. I can imagine some of that algae is all sticky. Maybe that's why you don't want to touch them.
Yeah, it's sticky. It's,
difficult to get to.
Difficult to get to, yeah.
This might be quite a fundamental question, but you mentioned that sometimes there's less and there's more of the algae. Is one better than the other? Is it telling you more about the overall system? Is that why you want to record it and find it out?
Most of all, Antarctica is a special place because sometimes we just want to know how much there is because it's such a remote place that we really have no clue of the actual estimates. So we don't know if the little observations we have of this system, of this biophysical system, are correct or are they valid or so on. So we go doing ice coring, which is a very labor intensive process. We make a hole through the ice and we get one sample, but you know that one sample might be very not representative of the entire system. So that's why we want to monitor first of all to see how much there is, but then how much is changing, right? Well, we either need to go through climate change and how the sea ice is changing and the consequence that might bring. We need to monitor them in order to understand.
Exactly. And how do you know exactly where to drill a hole in the ice? Because surely you don't want to just be camped out on the ice, make a hole, and then suddenly your floor's gone. So are there specific regions that you know are safe to drill into?
Well, that's a very good point. Like several times we had at least two campaigns cancelled because the sites we were planning to go, they actually got blown away by wind. So that's a good point. But we draw exactly the core. It's pretty much random in the beginning. We try to cover very different ice types, so then we can extrapolate stuff. We get different types, thick ice, thin ice, very snow-covered ice, and then so we can get an idea of how much algae there is on each type. So we kind of go around them. But the site-specific itself is mostly dependent if there is ice and the international program you're working with and the logistics they can support for.
So for your sensing, you use drones quite a lot. What kind of equipment do you use on these drones? And you say that you focus on hyperspectral and RGB imaging payloads.
Yeah.
Is that the equipment that you use on the drone?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Good point. So payload is a terminology to define the exact sensors we are mounting on the drone. And by drone, it's because it recently I've been working with both aerial and underwater drones. So drones were, you know, or unoccupied aerial and underwater vehicles. So we have the ones in the air, as everyone is familiar. We have the ones on the water, which are all remotely connected. They are unoccupied, so we avoid any risks. Coming back to the payload point, so this is the types of sensor. And remote sensing comprises very different type of sensors we can measure either, which are specialized in measuring physical properties, as I was talking, like the roughness or the height of the trees or the biological properties. And that really depends on the kind of wavelengths on the electromagnetic spectrum we're looking. So different wavelengths will tell you different properties of the system and different modalities of how that information about light is acquired. I will tell you a little bit more about this property. So I specialize in optical. So every remote sensing scientist has a sensor or a type of sensor they specialize with. I specialize in optical system, mostly in the visible range, so the range that our eyes are able to see, but a little bit further on, so a little bit beyond that range of the probably people have said about near infrared and so on. But we do this by acquiring this information quantitatively in a way that we can extract meaningful information from it. So our eyes are very good, but they don't tell you quantitative information about it, or they don't tell you all the wavelengths related to each other. So we rely on the sensors to be able to extract that information.
And are you involved in the designing and manufacturing of these drones, or are there companies that make them for different remote sensing scientists?
So this is a very good question. So it's a very fine line. So because these sensors are emerging in early days, we really had to work with manufacturers to get kind of the products that we wanted. So nowadays they're becoming more and more off the shelf. So it's becoming a bit more user-friendly in a way. The thing is that to make these sensors work, sometimes you need to put together different sensors that allow us to process that data, and that's why they are called payloads. So sometimes you will mix one of these optical sensors with a very high precision positioning and attitude information, so which tells you how much the sensor is its exact position over space, but also how much is it rolling, tilting, and yawing in relation to the axis, and that will be able to compose the images as you require. So it's the integration of all those. Some of the components are off the shelf, so they can be bidirectory, but it's the integration of all those sensors that needs to be mostly done by an institution at this stage. But it's becoming more and more accessible, so that's also good to open that frontier in science.
Stick with us, listeners, for part three, as we discuss Emiliano's future plans, challenges he's faced, and more. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and today we're talking to Emiliano, whose research focuses on the development and application of remote sensing methods to map and understand systems across the land and sea. Emiliano, as a drone pilot, I know that sometimes things can go wrong when flying drones. Do you have any stories of losing drones or crashing drones or anything going wrong there?
Yeah, I have actually a couple of funny ones. The first one was early days when drones were really much of a thing, 2015. Our objective was to map snow depth distribution. So again, coming back to the topic, it's physical properties of the terrain. So how much snow there is in an area. We were doing this in Greenland. I was working in Denmark at that time. And we had set, you usually set all these safety measurements. At the day, it wasn't as user-friendly as it is now. There is this come home position thing where, you know, when you switch a thing and a bottom and you can make it return to the place it landed or it started its flight. At the time, we were there in Greenland and we had switched on this button and for some reason, because in the very next to the North Pole, all the magnetic and the compass, they are not really properly working, don't give the accurate information. I remember that time we switched the button on to go home, it just went ballistic, bullet, go through us the opposite direction. Probably he was going back to Denmark or something. And it went so fast that then when you try to panic, because it's just your only drone or whatever, you're a pure student at the time, put it back in, couldn't get it on, and it just went straight down the snow. Well, the good thing about snow is that it didn't break. It was just full of water. But then as soon as you take it out, the motors melt the water, but then it freezes again in 5 minutes. So all the motors were stuck. So that's one. I still have a video of it. It's actually on the internet. I have a friend who always put it on every presentation. He actually teaches drone now in somewhere else, but it's a funny video because you can really see it coursing, following the drone through the snow with very big boots, falling, and then the drone falls. The second one was here in Tasmania, actually, with that was a bit of a thing. It was just a mechanical failure of the drone, and we were mapping Huon Pines. We were on an helicopter trip down the remote west coast. And it was a very nice place on top of a ridge, and you could see down the forest, and you can see actually by eye some of the location of the Huon Pines. We know that they are there. We were flying, and at some stage, you know, usually automate these flights, and they just go on different patterns. And at some stage, we just saw it going down because of a motor failure, and it just went down in the middle of the jungle, which means time was running out to get back into the chopper and coming back. So we had to go a little bit into the jungle and try to look for it. But luckily we found it. So that was good. It was actually, it wasn't that far away, but we couldn't find it, because how do you find it in the middle of, you don't know exactly where it falls. And we were about to give up, and then it was like a beep, beep. I don't know, I just felt like, it felt like one of those movies, you know, like Star Wars, when you're like in a remote planet and then you get sign off of different artifacts. And then we just found it, pick it up. And I mean, luckily that was a rescue for the sensors, because the sensors can be very expensive. We're talking about $70,000 sensors. So lucky we find it.
Wow, I would not want to be responsible for that amount of money. And it sounded like you were looking for R2-D2 in like the Ewok forest. That's
exactly
what I was imagining.
Exactly, that was exactly the vibe. It was, you know, you can imagine this beautiful lush Tasmanian forest. It could be a completely different planet. And then we had all this, yeah, it was about to lose hope, but then, yeah, it was calling for us.
That's so lucky. So what's been your most exciting discovery during your career in remote sensing?
Ooh, discovery. I was talking about before about the different types of remote sensing platforms. Satellites, you can see very large extent, but you can't really see the details of things. You narrow down with airplanes and so on, and you put the sensors that you cannot see a bit better. And now there's this new era where we are kind of equipping sensors on drones, and we are really getting to see this very complex detail, which is sometimes very challenging to deal with, because detail sometimes, we know, in every aspect of life is challenging. So I guess a bigger revelation was actually, sometimes I just did it because it was fun, right? I like this drone thing. I love the kind of robotics component of it, and I was doing it just for the pleasure of it. But actually, you realize so much of the detail can impact the larger scale processes. So you get to understand how much variable. So you look at a tree, for example, and you see it's not only green leaves, but you have so many types of different colors of leaves. And that's a different biological properties that can change within a single tree, right? And before, we couldn't capture those, what we call intraspecific differences of individuals and so on. And you know, we mostly average everything. Whatever. And that's really a revelation of, we realize how those things can really affect processes in different way. And that's, I think, a very interesting point, and it's a very good point for this type of close range technologies, drone technologies, to open us on elucidating better processes, but also better quantify them, right?
That's really cool. What has been your biggest challenge that you faced in your research? Have you come across any big barriers?
I guess when dealing with, most of the time we deal with polar sciences, if we stick to the scientific part, whatever, you know, everyone has personal challenges and so on. It's you can't expect it's in every field what happens, but you know, in polar science you have this case where you can really have all your plants turn upside down from one moment to the other, entire fieldwork campaigns being cancelled at the last minute and so on. I guess that's in a way makes your life easier because you don't have to go. But on the other hand, it makes challenges you to find another solution to the problem. So yeah, I will say that makes it a challenge, I guess.
And it's hard to study something that's so remote, and you really have to rely on that transport being available.
Yeah. The transports and the logistics and yeah, of course, then you have all the details about, you know, things not working and so on. But I guess those, you figure it out, as long as you have all the rest on your back supporting you. That's it. The good people. And that's it.
Have you ever got down to Antarctica on a field trip to deploy a drone and realize there was a particular type of battery that you left back in Hobart?
Actually, yes, that was so funny. It wasn't funny for my boss, but it was funny now. So this was just a recent fact. We had this amazing collaboration with some people from the University of Wollongong and the Antarctic Division. We're working on using drones and this hyperspectral imaging to map moss health and water content. So Antarctic moss is very remote type of life, pretty much like the forest of Antarctica. There's nothing else that's green over there. So we're looking at using these drones to map over there. It was COVID time, so we had 2 weeks of quarantine. We were about to leave the last, you know, you barely survive with your mental health and sanity after 1 week and a half in an hotel room. And we were about to leave. We left and we arrived there, and one of the antennas of the drones, which is the main thing to give positioning to the camera, I was talking before about orientation and positioning, I just didn't pack it up. So just, and no way, it's not like you talk about a screw. Here we're talking about like a 1 meter, 1.5 meter antenna. It wasn't there. And so what happened? Luckily for us, there was a last flight coming on after us. And I'm going to, I'm going to have to give help to my boss and to, what was the name of the artist? Janet Lawrence. We managed to, it was a Sunday, I remember, so I had to send a message to Arco from Antarctica, which Arco's my boss, was most of the time. We say, oh, we forgot the main antenna. I don't know how, but it happened. So luckily there was someone else, this artist, who was coming up on a flight, which was delayed of 2 days, luckily, and he was leaving the next morning. So they picked up the antenna, they delivered it to the quarantine hotel, and she got it to Antarctica for us. Because that was the last flight of the season. So we would have to spend the entire month with nothing. And just because of a silly thing. And it's just those things that, the most obvious ones. Sometimes you really looking at that detail, oh, that screw or that thing or that thing. And then the most obvious thing, you forget to pack. And it was, that was crisis averted.
These things happen. Like in all areas of research, silly things like these happen, and it does really affect the whole of your field season. So you were really lucky there.
Yeah.
A final question for you, Emiliano. Do you have any big research plans for the future, or what is your dream for you in this area of research? Do you have any big goals?
Any plans for the future? No big plans for the future per se, but I'm very interested in the research topic, so I hope to continue working on it. I'll be very curious. There are so many interesting, as I said, biophysical systems around the world, from the poles to the tropics, so that'll give me opportunity to study things, and hopefully to demonstrate also, not only to demonstrate, but to make available this new type of data, this high resolution data, and demonstrate that it can be very useful for larger scale processes. So that would be one. And, get into trouble, get out of it. And if we can't demonstrate anything, just have fun. That's it.
Nice. I love that. Forget the occasional antenna. Remember it.
Exactly.
Back and forth. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you, listener, for tuning in to That's What I Call Science. We love bringing you STEM-related content and hope you enjoyed the show. If you didn't think we droned on today and you loved the show, you can get in touch with us by searching That's What I Call Science or That Science Taz on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. My name is Ollie Dove, and I'd like to thank my co-host Hannah Moore and our expert guest, Dr. Emiliano Cimoli. From us three, we hope you all have a wonderful week. This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. That's What I Call Science is brought to your station and across the nation via the Community Radio Network. You can find the show at all major podcast streaming services and find out more about us from our social media channels. Make sure you like and subscribe to keep up with all the exciting science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine research in Lutruwita, Tasmania. This show is supported and strengthened by Edge Radio, so head over to edgeradio.org.au for more information about them. Thanks for tuning in today, and may your week be STEM-tastic.